From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
As of January, 27% of white evangelicals said they believe QAnon was completely or mostly accurate, and 49% thought Antifa was responsible for the Capitol violence.
Predictably, the two weird for the National Enquirer conspiracies of QAnon found fertile ground in extremist nationalist Christian circles. While it's impossible for most of the rest of us to even understand how anyone can take this stuff seriously, there remains the question of how far this can possibly go. Equally important is the topic Mark Juergensmeyer explores in his recent Religion Dispatches article, Vainglory Days, a foremost expert on religious violence, offers clues to how QAnon might end. The author will be back with us on this week's show.
1,500 pastors a month in the U.S. are leaving the ministry because of burnout. 80% of the pastors admit to feeling unqualified or discouraged. 50% want to leave the ministry, but they have nowhere else to go.
Many segments of our society have been under incredible pressure these past few years. Between the excruciating divisiveness of partisan ideology and the suffering engendered by the pandemic, clergy in particular have been facing unprecedented levels of exhaustion and burnout. One attempt to help comes in the form of Respite for Revs, a campaign coordinated by a number of faith-oriented groups, including Baptist Women in Ministry. We'll check on how it's going with that group's executive director, Meredith Stone.
You know, a lot of times you ask yourself, how do I become a good citizen? What do I do to live out my freedom in this amazing nation? How do I honor those who came before me that sacrificed for me to be able to have this freedom? And as a believer, how do I live out a biblical citizenship in modern America?
Biblical citizenship. It sounds like a nice enough concept for the Bible, perhaps, but create a national framework for promoting the concept here in the United States, and you got a big problem. One of many, as the theocratic political religious right finds more and more ways to move mainstream discourse and public policy further and further away from the pluralistic, tolerant, and inclusive vision of our founding fathers and most of the rest of us. A worrying report appeared a few weeks ago in the Deseret News asking, what is biblical citizenship? And we'll get at least part of the answer from the author, religion reporter Maya Jaradat. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now to our first guest. The almost encouraging Religion Dispatches headline reads, Vainglory Days, a foremost expert on religious violence offers clues to how QAnon might end. Written by Dr. Mark Juergensmeyer, it draws on the author's lifetime of expertise on global religion and religiously motivated violence. Mark, it's been a while since the last time you were on the show. I'm really glad to be able to welcome you back on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, my pleasure. I look forward to our conversation.
Well, it's the very outrageousness of QAnon rhetoric that makes understanding its adherence so impossible. What makes it so unshakably believable to those who buy into it?
Well, one of the people who have analyzed this is somebody who creates computer games. And he says the formula of QAnon is based on computer games, where you don't discover things outright. You're just dropped hints. In QAnon, they're called drops. So you get little bits of clues. It's almost like a treasure hunt. So as you kind of put things together, and of course, this is not done randomly at all. there's already a design behind it. They know what you're supposed to find and how it's supposed to lead. But when you're doing it, when you put these little clues together, you feel like you're discovering it yourself. And that's a remarkable thing. You then internalize knowledge. You're looking at, it may be a wacky view of the world, but if you begin to put these little pieces together and you discover, my God, this is what's really going on. Mm. And as extraordinary as it may seem, it just unearths a whole different reality that you had no idea that existed, and you discovered it yourself. And that's why the QAnon knowledge is almost like Gnosticism. It's almost like the hidden knowledge, those who have ears, let them hear. It is in a sense like a discovery of religious knowledge, some secret trove of information. And more than a trove of information, it's a worldview. It's a whole perception of the way in which our reality is being controlled.
I still can't understand how this stuff gains credence in religious communities and congregations.
Well, for one thing, there's an eerie similarity between the apocalypticism, the end times of QAnon, and the apocalypticism and the end time of millenarian evangelical Christianity. It's not the rapture and the cataclysm described in the book of Revelation, but it's the storm. It's called the storm. There is some cataclysmic moment to which this is all leading. And at that moment, then the Savior will return. It's not the familiar Savior of Jesus mm-hmm. Christ. It's Donald Trump. And he will return in his second term of office. And then finally, these evildoers will be banished. They'll be set down to Guantanamo to be banished forever in prison, or they'll be executed, they'll be dispatched, and the world will reign in peace, which is why the second term of Donald Trump had to come into being. It was simply required by this kind of cosmology, and the notion that he didn't win was obviously a fake, was obviously rigged. It couldn't possibly be true. So you can begin to understand that kind of vehemence with which the adherents of this, who now have internalized this, they thought they have discovered this truth as such a solid, unshakable truth that it's unimaginable that anything could differ so wildly than their belief, because it is a kind of religious belief. It is does parallel messianic, millenarian, evangelical Christianity.
Mark, you have deep expertise in religion and violence around the world, and I was going to ask you if there was anything parallel to QAnon, and you've already said, yes, it is, and I'm surprised by that, but interested in you knowing that.
Yes. I had a theological training before I became a political scientist, so I've always been interested in religion and politics and the intertwining of the two. Mm-hmm. And as you know, over 30 years now, I've been looking at movements of religious violence and religious nationalism. Right. And many of them follow the same kind of trajectory as QAnon. Mm-hmm. Let's take ISIS. They have the most fantastic kind of apocalyptic narrative about the end of the world and demons, and now the demons are Shia and Jews and Americans, but nonetheless, you have a similar kind of notion that the world is controlled by an evil cabal. And yet ISIS has now been defeated, at least militarily. And so in this book that I'm showing you a picture of it, because it just came out. This is my first copy. It just arrived 2 days ago.
Good for you.
Yeah, thank you. And it should be available soon. It's called When God Stops Fighting, How Religious Violence Ends. And so I've looked at the way in which movements like this end around the world, and including ISIS. And I've spent years now talking with militants who are very closely associated with the movement, including those now in prison in northern Iraq who were fighters for ISIS, and to try to see how they have viewed the ending of the movement. And most of them are reconciled with the fact that it's ended, even though they still have this deep longing for a caliphate. They still have, you know, the idea that maybe someday the caliphate would return again. Mm-hmm. But they're willing to accept the reality that the movement is over. Mm-hmm. And that, it seems to me, is a parallel for how QAnon might end, a day in which members of it might grudgingly accept the reality that the rest of us see around us, even though maybe somewhere in their hearts they still believe, yeah, QAnon may be true, and it may happen, but maybe not right away.
I want our listeners to understand how QAnon may fade away as you describe it in the article.
There's several things, and this is where it fits would fit into a pattern that is similar to these other movements that I've studied, and how their own kind of views of cosmology and a great war and a great turmoil and their own conspiracy theories might dissipate. And there are really three major factors. One is internal dissension, where they're infighting within the movement, where leaders are discredited for one reason or the other, and people began to be disillusioned with the unity and the very frail human character of the leadership that they have in their movement. And we're already seeing this in QAnon just this last week. Michael Flynn now has been accused of being perverse, and right, other members are seen to be pilfering money that was supposed to be used for legal purposes and put in their own pockets. Donald Trump himself, of course, has been accused of that. And so as the image of the strong leadership begins to fade and fighting begins, that's one way, and people become to lose faith in the movement. Mm-hmm. The other is simply to be reminded that there is another world, that people see things differently, and that you can't just go around killing people without impunity, and you can't launch an insurrection against the government of the United States without being legally accountable. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that now with the January 6th trials, and even the QAnon shaman has just received 41 months in prison for his role of sitting in the seat of Mike Pence in the Senate chambers, and as if he was the king of the world. So reality is another kind of boundary. Yeah. And the third and maybe most meaningful is to see some hope, to see a way out, to see a face-saving way out, because many people who have taken on the QAnon ideas have already suffered a certain amount of scorn from their friends and neighbors and family who think they're crazy. And that they persist because they think they've found a real truth. How do you retreat from that? Mm-hmm. You know, it's very difficult to one day say, oh, you're right, I was foolish, all of this is wrong. It's much more easy to try to find another way of thinking about this. And I think the simple way, since so many of the QAnon followers are already evangelical millenarian Christians, is to go back to the apocalypse of the book of Revelation, to go back to the notion that the storm that they're talking about really is the rapture, and the savior who will come is not Donald Trump, but it's the old savior that they've been believing in for years, Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And so they're able to re-religionize, in a sense, these beliefs, I think it'd be a way of moving back into a more acceptable understanding of the world and a more acceptable kind of religiosity, because QAnon in some ways is an alternative religion. Mm-hmm. And they may discover that their old-time religion really is good enough for them.
So a loss of faith is the antidote to a misguided faith.
Yes, a loss of faith and maybe a recovery of faith at the same time.
Okay. As I read you, there's not a lot non-believers can do to effectively challenge false beliefs. That's got to come from the believers themselves. So is there anything the rest of us can do at all to help move this process forward for all of our sake?
That's a good question, and you're right. Simply to argue with people makes them defensive, and because, after all, they have this internalized knowledge, and so it's really futile to try to argue with them on the basis of what they believe. But I think we can certainly remind them of reality. That is, remind people of how the rest of the world looks at the rest of the world, and how there are limits on actions in a civil society and what is permissible and what is not permissible in order simply to make the society function. Those kind of reminders, I think, are appropriate and helpful, and they help to bring reality into their vision of the world. Mm-hmm. But simply arguing with them on the basis of belief never works. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work, by the way, with ISIS either. A lot of the counterterrorism efforts have been to try to convert people back to a normal form of Islam and not this extremist form that ISIS believes in. Mm-hmm. And that never works because they believe that they have the truth. Mm-hmm. What does work is an acceptance of reality that then allows them to imagine this alternative version of Islam, this alternative reality, but in a kind of idealistic way, in a metaphorical way, in a legendary way, in a way that doesn't intrude on reality and cause people harm or to others or themselves.
Mark, you go a lot deeper on all of this in your newest book. What do you focus on in When God Stops Fighting, How Religious Violence Ends?
Well, I focus on how people in the movements perceive it. In other words, all of my research is based on conversations, going out and talking with people, not interviews in the sense of interrogating them or having a whole set of questions, because often I don't know what questions to ask because I'm trying to get inside their world, try to understand the world as they see it. And that means reading what they've written and talking with them in a way that just lets them open up. And so I've begun to see how they've seen ISIS as an alternative reality, or the other movements that I've studied, the Moro movement in the Philippines, the Khalistan movement in the Punjab, and this is also true of QAnon, how people see it from within and take it as wacky as we might think those ideas are, but they seem to the adherents, the believers, as credible because they've found these things out themselves. And the more extreme it appears to us, the more certain they are of it, because that they've discovered this deep truth, and it scares them as well as us. Mm. And so they want to warn us because they've seen this truth. Now, it's not a truth. It's a fiction that's been created by the agile kind of manipulation of these hints, these clues, these drops in QAnon terms, but appears to be true. And so we have to respect that, back off, at the same time letting people know that they have limits. I'd say if we have friends and family who are QAnon supporters, love them, accept them, tell them we still love them, make clear we don't believe this, make clear that we think that there's another reality. Maybe suggest that, you know, the vision given in the Bible is still a good vision to rely on and not QAnon. But don't try to argue with them. Don't dismiss them. After all, they're also children of God, and I think redeemable, and the movement can be redeemed.
So ultimately, you are optimistic that this can fade away, and if so, isn't it likely something even more extreme might appear in its place?
Yes, of course. We just got to move from one thing to another. And extreme times lead to extreme religion. And we are in an extreme time, a lot of dramatic social changes and a kind of eruptions of the economy and politics and social identity, in part caused by globalization, because now there are the challenges of old ways of thinking about our secure nationalistic identities and our economic roles. And all of this has been upended in the last several decades. So these are challenging times, and it is understandable and always has been historically that in moments of social change, there are extreme movements that come and capture people's imagination, seen as a kind of harbor in a storm, to use actually QAnon's term, to some kind of refuge. So it's understandable. And some become religions. Some, you know, some endure for a long time. And that is, of course, one possible trajectory. But more likely, and this is certainly the case in all the movements that I've studied, after a while, they dissipate. And they dissipate for the reasons that I give, and the leadership is not strong enough to really carry the trust and faith of the believers very long. People grow up, people change, they're tired of fighting with their neighbors and family over these issues. And they begin to see that there are other ways of looking at reality and that they've been very limited. So inevitably, it seems to me, these movements do change. It's just a question of when, how long, and whether we have the patience to let them endure until they are completed.
Dr. Mark Juergensmeyer is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Sociology and Global Studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Among his important books is God at War, A Meditation on Religion and Warfare. And next month, University of California Press is publishing his latest, When God Stops Fighting, How Religious Violence Ends. We'll link to Mark's Religion Dispatches article exploring how QAnon might end from stateofbelief.com. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Up next, Baptist Women in Ministry. You'll meet Executive Director Meredith Stone, and later, what on earth is biblical citizenship? You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gay. Respite for Revs. It's a smooth-sounding initiative to address a growing crisis among American clergy. I am joined by Meredith Stone. She's executive director of Baptist Women in Ministry, one of the partner groups supporting the Respite program. Meredith, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
How would you describe the clergy crisis Respite for Revs is designed to stem?
What we notice is that many of our pastors and ministers that are a part of the community that Baptist Women in Ministry serves, they are just exhausted. During the pandemic, a lot of folks thought that ministers, oh, well, they're just recording their sermons now. They're not doing anything. But in reality, their workload was doubled, tripled, quadrupled as they were learning what things look like for the virtual church. But then also, as we began to emerge and folks began meeting again, there's been this shift in the way that we do church life, added on top of new responsibilities. And so our clergy have just really borne the brunt of this pandemic in our faith communities. And so many people still need such intense pastoral care as not only people of faith, but people across the globe are struggling to such an extent. And so our clergy are such an important part of addressing the needs of our global community in this moment. And so we want to offer a chance for them to have a little bit of respite so they can recharge and continue to do the good and necessary work of building communities that are healthy and find wholeness.
Describe the way the program is designed to help people, if you would.
The program developed, really, we tried to make it as simple as possible in that we want to offer congregations, especially Baptist congregations for who we are serving and a couple of the other organizations that are a part. We want to offer them the chance for a representative from one of our organizations to come preach on a Sunday at no cost to the congregation in exchange for them giving an extra week of vacation to their clergy member. Some of our organizations are even willing to try and work out some Wednesday activities or midweek kinds of things as well. But all of us have a staff of a few folks at least who could come and preach on a Sunday morning and at least give one extra week of vacation time so that hopefully the clergy will have a chance to spend time in renewal.
How nice. How did Baptist Women in Ministry get involved in this particular initiative?
Honestly, Mitch Randall from Good Faith Media had written a blog, an article about just recognizing the difficulties clergy were experiencing. And he made the offer, hey, I'll come at no charge to your congregation to give your clergy person an extra week off. And when I read the article, I thought, you know, I could do that too. Our organization would love to be connecting with congregations, and I could make that same offer. So I sent Mitch an email and said, you know, I could do this too, and I think I'm not the only one. And we started talking about some of our friends who we thought might want to get involved in this, and the conversation just bloomed from there.
How can both faith leaders who feel they need support and people of goodwill who want to offer support get connected to Respite for Revs?
A great place to start. If you are a person who is in a congregation, a lay person, and you see that your clergy person could really use that extra break, we would love for you to initiate this and contact one of our organizations and say, we want to do this for our clergy person. Unfortunately, sometimes the clergy people are the ones who see it the most. They don't feel like they can show their need to their congregation. And then it's kind of awkward for them to have to ask. So if you are a lay person, ask your clergy if this is something that they could use and contact us, arrange all the details. And another way to support this would be to give to any of the organizations who are a part of this initiative, Baptist Joint Committee, Passport Camps, Baptist News Global, Good Faith Media, and Baptist Women in Ministry. Make your donation specific to Respite for Revs, and we will use that money as a part of our expenses to travel to those congregations.
Meredith, I was there at the beginning of Baptist Women in Ministry. Many of my best friends were leaders early on. I've always supported the work of this organization because of what you have been doing all of these years. I'm interested now in learning more about what the organization is doing right now, other than what you've talked about already. But maybe it would be good for our listeners if you just talked for a moment about how did Baptist Women in Ministry get started?
Yeah. Nearly 40 years ago, the Southern Baptist Convention was experiencing some polarizing views on a number of different issues, one of which was women in ministry. And so as that convention began to move more conservative in their views about women in ministry, a group of folks emerged to say, we don't think that this is right. We think that God has called all people. We think that men and women are made in the image of God and that God gives them gifts to serve and lead in congregations. And so a group of folks got together, started this organization as a means to begin advocating for women in ministry among Baptists. And that was around the time that we began to see the formation of different Baptist groups who had different views on various things, including women in ministry. And so we grew with that. We grew alongside of those other Baptist groups who did want to support the ordination of women, but were in process. So most of the Baptist congregations we work with are, some of them are still trying to figure it out, but others are ones who maybe decided 20, 30 years ago that they were going to ordain women as deacons, but they haven't quite figured out how to make the next steps of really embracing women's gifts throughout the life of a congregation. And so we want to serve alongside of those congregations. We want to advocate for women to continue to grow in their leadership and ministry, for their voices to be elevated. And so that's a huge part of our work, and it continues to change as we grow. The other part of our work is the encouraging and equipping of the women who are serving in ministry. We still see such small percentages of our clergy in various ministerial roles who are women. And so it's very isolating for them to be in those places. They need community. They need support in ways that we want to offer. And so we have programs that are designed to do that. Our signature program is a mentoring program that we offer for women who are just starting out in ministry to have a mentor and some peers to walk alongside of them for 2 years as a way of building in a foundation to sustain a lifetime of ministry, knowing that there are going to be obstacles, knowing that patriarchy still exists within the church. Whenever an institution like the church has been founded on patriarchy for 2,000 years, we're not going to get rid of it, even in 30 or 40 years. And so we have to continue to work together, and we want to support women as they're facing those obstacles together.
So what kind of questions do you face working under the name Baptist Women in Ministry as you do?
Yeah, we have some partner congregations who have slogans something like a different kind of Baptist, or, you know, not that kind of Baptist, because there is, as you said, just this association with Baptists of really sexism, among other issues. And I think as we've seen in the past few years, the charges, the allegations, the history of sexual abuse that has been a part of Southern Baptist churches and perhaps within Southern Baptist leadership itself, there has been this huge outcry, I think, even among Baptists who are perhaps more conservative, to begin to start realizing the connection between this theology that says women are somehow less than and a culture of abuse. And so as we talk to folks, we want to help them understand that there are faithful ways of reading scripture in which women can be valued, to not be limited, to not be seen as less than or diminished. And we want to help folks understand that there are other Baptist communities that are still holding on to the Baptist freedoms that our Baptist heritage has been founded upon, who are becoming supportive of women in ministry and who are still growing in that. We're not there. We are working toward it, but there are places where Baptists who want to find that sense of being in solidarity with the idea that God truly does value all people, there are Baptists who can find a community, though it may not be as large. It may not be the one that folks have associated Baptists with. Other communities do exist.
What are some other challenges that you and your constituents face in today's political religious environment, particularly among American evangelicals?
Oh, what a great question. I've been in this role for just a little over a year. So I entered into it during the very contentious 2020 election season, as we continue to become more polarized as a society in general and within the church. And one of the questions that I had to ask myself was, how much time are we going to spend on trying to change people's minds? Because people don't seem to want to change their minds about anything these days. They're becoming even more entrenched in their ideas. And how much time do we spend on folks who maybe have changed their mind, but really need to take the next steps? And as I started out, I really leaned into, gosh, we've got to focus on the folks who've already changed their mind. There's no way we're ever going to get people to change their minds on this. But I have a friend who I serve on a board with, Reverend Dr. John Ogletree, who's down in the Houston, Texas area, who has been on a school board for a number of years. And he faced backlash this year in his reelection season in regard to his efforts around diversity and inclusion, around including anti-racism within their school district. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, Dr. Ogletree, how do you balance this idea of continuing to try and change people's minds when you are in this situation and just saying, hey, this is where people are, we back off? And he said, Meredith, we have to continue to wave the flag. If we don't wave the flag, then nobody else will. And so he's been a great encouragement to me to say, we have to do both. We have to continue to try and help people see that there is another way that we can understand how God is working through women in our faith communities. And we also want to work with folks who are on the journey already and figuring out where to go next. So I think the answer to the question is yes. Lots of challenges in our society today, yeah, with politics, evangelicalism for women in ministry.
Listen, before we go, tell our listeners how they can find out more about the work of Baptist Women in Ministry.
Great. You can visit us online at www.bwim.info. And we are on social media at Baptist Women. And so you can find us there. We would love to connect with you, to share with you more about our work, and to find ways that we can partner with you in order to affirm, elevate the voices and leadership of women in Baptist communities of faith.
Meredith Stone is Executive Director of Baptist Women in Ministry, one of a growing group of concerned groups supporting the Respite for Revs campaign. Find out more at respiteforrevs.org. Meredith, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
In 1972, I became the director of citizenship development for the Social Ethics Agency in the Southern Baptist Convention. It was a good place to be, a progressive place to be. The first book that I ever wrote on religion and politics was on Christian citizenship. There is a fundamentalist reconstruction of America going on at a terrifying number of levels. What I wrote then and what I am reading now are poles apart in the courts, in legislatures, and most dangerously behind the scenes in areas like education, suppressing long-held pluralistic values and injecting Christianist white supremacist and misogynistic ones, the dominionist dream of controlling the so-called seven mountains of society hasn't come true yet, but it keeps getting closer. And so it was with alarm that I read Deseret News religion reporter Maya Jaradat's recent article headlined, "What is Biblical Citizenship?" But let's find out, since the author is back with us again today. Maya, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start right there. What is biblical citizenship?
Biblical citizenship. I mean, look, the term sounds okay on the surface, right? I mean, it sounds just fine. If, you know, you're thinking about the Bible from the kind of context of loving your neighbor, you know, what does that mean? Loving your neighbor means taking care of them. I mean, that's my perspective. So it sounds okay in theory, but the version of biblical citizenship that is circulating, you know, in Christian nationalist circles now is exactly that. It's a kind of thinly veiled or not so thinly veiled attempt to kind of assert Christian nationalism. Mm-hmm. And I do feel that it is an attempt to kind of disrupt some of the cornerstones of democracy, you know, just through this kind of approach of, mm-hmm. you know, saying that the Bible and God comes before our democratic institutions.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You enrolled in a course to prepare you to be a good biblical citizen. Who runs this course and how is it promoted?
Yeah, so the course is offered by Rick Green and his Patriot Academy. What's interesting, really, really actually kind of interesting to me is the structure of the course, that the materials are available for free online. So basically, anyone can kind of, quote unquote, run a course, if you will. And this was emphasized at the end of the course itself, that anyone can get the materials and just kind of offer them up or play them to small groups, you know, whether in their homes or in churches. So it's easy to spread the material. And I think that's a really important aspect of the course. And what, you know, Rick Green and others are doing is they really want this stuff to spread like seeds throughout the nation and take root. And, you know, something that I felt was a little jarring about one of the people who spoke in the course, who, you know, was a quote unquote constitution coach who had led courses in biblical citizenship at a church. She, you know, she said that you don't have to really worry about understanding the content. You can just kind of pop it in and hit play. And I thought, well, my goodness, that's a bit dangerous, you know, that you're going to just be a vehicle to spread this content that you may or may not fully understand. Like, that really struck me and made me uncomfortable with the content, if that makes sense.
Who is Rick?
So Rick Green is a former Texas state legislator. It is important to note where I first came across the term biblical citizenship. Mm-hmm. I first heard the term in connection to a rally that I attended in Dalton, Georgia last December. It was ahead of the Senate runoffs and, you know, in Georgia, mm-hmm. that were so important, especially in the wake of Biden's win. So I first encountered the term biblical citizenship last year ahead of the event in Dalton. And I heard about this quote unquote biblical citizenship barnstorming tour. Now that's a bit of a mouthful. I was like, wait, what is this? A biblical citizenship barnstorming tour. So I went to the church there in Dalton, and there Rick Green, the former Texas state legislator, Rick Green, and the former U.S. Representative Michelle Bachmann both spoke. And I, you know, I continued to kind of puzzle over the term. And that's when I decided that I wanted to take one of Rick Green's free 8-week courses mm-hmm. on the topic. You know, the funny thing, I have to say that one of the funniest parts of trying to figure out what biblical citizenship is and how to write this piece was that I never got a straightforward answer. Like, there's never a moment in the course where they go, biblical citizenship is X, Y, Z, and this is how you do it. They spend 8 classes kind of talking around it. You know what I mean? And so I found that kind of baffling. So I did reach out to Rick Green for, I really wanted a super clear, I was like, can you tell me in a sentence, can you define this term for me? And so the answer I got was that Rick Green told me via email, a constitutional republic works best when citizens follow the biblical commands on everything from obeying just laws, proper taxation, work ethic, loving your neighbor, freedom of choice, free market principles, and so many other issues that affect our daily lives. Okay, which is still kind of amorphous, but basically what they're driving at with these courses is that they really want Americans, Christians to be specific, and conservative Christians to be even more specific, to become deeply involved in the political process. And I think that's kind of the most important aspect of the course, is that they want people taking this information out and spreading it, but they also want people running for office. And this is was really interesting to hear this emphasis on asking people to run for office. I mean, from, you know, small things like the local school board all the way up, you know, to congressional seats. And this is, I mean, that was a fascinating thing to me because I've heard a number of pastors have mentioned this to me in the past year or so. I wonder where the rhetoric is coming from. And the language I've heard from pastors, you know, conservative kind of right wing pastors has all been the same as well. Like, we need to get Christians running for office. You know, it needs to be like a whole ballot thing, right? From the bottom, you know, the lowest, smallest offices all the way to the top. I heard this at Faith and Freedom Coalition. It's rhetoric I keep hearing over and over and over again. And then the other thing that was compelling to me about Rick Green and a parallel I keep hearing from pastors is this black robed regimen that's being invoked. I've heard pastors have brought it up with me. Rick Green brought it up during a lecture on biblical citizenship, not during the course, but during a lecture about biblical citizenship at a church. Mm-hmm. There's this invoking of this black robed regimen, which historians actually say is a misappropriation of what, you know, what the idea was during the Revolutionary War, but that they've taken this idea and this image and they're trying to kind of refashion it as a really almost a call to arms is a bit unnerving to me.
So what is the objective here? Nobody offers a free course like this without a master plan to do something.
Mm-hmm. I think you hit on a really important point, actually, is that, you know, they keep talking about a republic, by the way. In the course, they talk about a republic. And so, you know, conversation about democracy is not mm-hmm. really at the heart of the course. It's about a Christian republic. Now, look, as a minority myself, you know, and I respect Christianity and I'm very familiar with Christianity and I've read portions of the New Testament and I admire, you know, the messages there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm Jewish. I'm a minority in this country. And so I feel, you know, a little bit uncomfortable, maybe more than a little bit uncomfortable with this idea that Christianity should hold sway and that, you know, what does that mean for someone like me? And my husband's a Muslim. Like, what does mm-hmm. that mean for people like us? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, they're not talking about democracy. They're talking about a republic and they're talking about kind of the brass tacks of how to kind of, as Rick Green put it, get into the mixing bowl of the political process to make that republic, you know, Christian republic manifest.
Mm-hmm. How big a thing is this? Do you know how many people are getting programmed to be a good biblical citizen?
You know, I'm estimating it, kind of roughly estimating it in the thousands. I think it's kind of hard to pin down because you don't know, you know, how many people have taken the programming into their homes or into their churches. But, you know, Rick Green has also gone to speak at churches mm-hmm. about biblical citizenship. So it's not just a passive thing that they're offering up this programming for people to take, you know, from the website and share in their churches. It's also that he's actively promoting it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen a couple of videos on YouTube with him talking about biblical citizenship that have thousands of views, you know, and then you have to kind of think about the numbers of, you know, it's not just the people participating in the course. It's also like, you know, the courses that are being led in churches, mm-hmm. you know, biblical citizenship courses that are being led in churches. Yeah. You know, in my article, I mention one of the Constitution coaches who has been doing this for quite a while. I mean, almost a decade. And he said that his name is Ken Davis. And he said that in 2012, you know, he led his first class, Constitution Alive, you know, it was Rick Green's materials. He led his first class in basically a closet in the church. And there were only three participants. But as things are kind of catching on, his classes have grown. The demand for this material has grown. And so now he's offering 3 10-week classes a year. And his last course had 60 enrollees and took place in the church's auditorium. So, I mean, I think that, you know, we're seeing some of the language and ideas catch on, you know, in that they're catching on and they're kind of taking on a life of their own. By the way, I want to add, I pulled up the email from Rick Green and to offer one of the definitions he offered me of biblical citizenship. And this is a definition that did not make the story. My editor cut it because she felt like it was a little bit too amorphous, and I agree, but I want to share it with you guys. Okay. So this is a direct quote from Rick Green. He says, "Biblical citizenship in modern America is simply following biblical instruction on living out one's rights and responsibilities under the United States Constitution. For followers of Christ, this is not optional and is a practical application of discipleship under the Great Commission. For non-Christians, there is still great benefit to individuals and society when following the wisdom of the Bible." So that's the quote he offered me, you know, which my editor felt like she said, I still don't understand what biblical citizenship is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do want to offer it to you guys, you know, for our listeners.
These days, it's hard to decide which is a bigger threat to our democracy, extremist religious forces driving politics or politics perverting religion. Which side does this fall on?
You know what? I think about that question a lot, and I want to relate to it as someone who spent almost a decade in Israel. You know, I'm American Israeli. I also covered Israel as a journalist. And my focus was on, you know, among other things, I was really interested in the democratic space in Israel. Why am I talking about Israel? Because in Israel, we've seen this kind of shift to the right,
yes,
a broad kind of shift to the right. But it's happened by this process of kind of extremists who have broadened the tent. Right. And as they kind of broaden the tent, it pulls all the rhetoric to the right and it makes things that were once unacceptable. It brings them into the mainstream. Now, it's really interesting how extremism has worked over there, that you know, these really radical right wing, they say crazy things, they do crazy things that can kind of be rejected by the mainstream, but they just nudge the kind of they nudge things over little by little, you know, until things that were not acceptable in the mainstream do become acceptable. And I kind of feel like we're watching the same process happen now in the United States, that like the tent is being broadened. Some of the people on the far right, you know, are obviously discredited widely, but they by just offering the rhetoric and allowing themselves to be this kind of, it's a kind of funny process, right? Because we can discredit them and it makes us feel more comfortable by discrediting these far right. It's like it becomes the like kind of sort of right things become more acceptable. It's a very strange process, right? But that's the process I kind of see happening now, that there's this broadening of the tent that's nudging everything more to the right.
Ultimately, if the promoters of biblical citizenship get their way, what would our nation look like a few years down the road?
I mean, it wouldn't be a democracy.
Maya Jaradat is religion reporter at Deseret News and the author of the book, The Unchosen, The Lives of Israel's New Others. We'll link to her article, What is Biblical Citizenship, from stateofbelief.com. Maya, it's always great to talk with you, and I'm glad we did it again today. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Thank you. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what?